Welcome to Wednesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, the CDC has made changes to the recommendations for the childhood vaccine schedule, and our regional news podcast, Prairie Beat, will dig into the ramifications. Plus, from the classroom to the control tower, the University of North Dakota has reached a milestone as Anthony Lake has become the first graduate of the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Controller Program. We'll visit with Anthony to see what's ahead for him.
I like bagels.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
Welcome to Prairie Plates, served weekly here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. We're going to go to Bismarck today and talk about the downtown Bismarck Burger Slam, which is currently going on. And we have a special guest on today, Don Kopp, who is the director of the Bismarck Downtowners Association. We've had Don on a few times. She does a great job, so we thought we'd ask her back. Thanks for being here, Don.
Thanks for having me back, Rick. I'm really happy to be with you today. Talking about burgers and burger slams and all the good stuff we have going on.
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about 11 entries this year, right?
Yes, 11, which is exciting. And we're going to try to get to them all.
Yeah, some very unique burgers, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But tell us about this year's Downtown Burger Slam. What's similar? What's different?
Yeah, so we have quite a few businesses competing again. We have 11, which is up from last year by a couple. We have some really strong contenders that have participated now all 3 years, and we have some new ones as well that are dipping their toe into the burger pool, if you will. So it's really exciting. We have lots of different unique burgers as well, lots of different proteins. So it'll be really exciting to talk about this.
Why are you doing it again this year?
Yeah, so, you know, January is usually the time of the year where people are finished with the holidays, and they're kind of, you know, looking to slow down a little bit, but still want to get out and support local, hopefully. But also, it's a slower time of the year for our restaurants and retailers. It's a slower month, January, February. Just usually, we don't have this beautiful weather that we're having right now. So with the slower month or slower sales months, we wanted to try to pick that up a little bit and see what we could do to increase sales at our restaurant members. And so a few years ago, people at the Blarney Stone here in Bismarck were talking to us about bringing Burger Slam to Bismarck. They do it in Sioux Falls. And so finally, 3 years ago, so that would be 2024, we did our very first Burger Slam. It went really well, and now we're just cruising.
And you've added more this year, 11 competitors.
Yes, 11. So it's really exciting. What we do is we recommend or suggest, I would say, if you don't want to eat 11 full burgers by yourself or order a burger for yourself, find a group of people and go to several different restaurants, split the burgers, and you can try, you know, a couple in a night or over lunch, something like that. But it's very exciting to give them all a shot, and you can then vote for them on our app.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that later too, but I did notice some offerings from some ethnic restaurants like India Clay Oven, Jomo House. I haven't been to Jomo House yet, but I love India Clay Oven. It's one of my favorite restaurants in the state of North Dakota, actually.
Yeah, they do a great job. Their burger this year is called the Maharaja Burger, and it's a ground lamb patty that is seasoned with their own blend of Indian spices, plus some fresh mint and fresh cilantro. If you are the person that is no cilantro, tastes like soap, I would say that this is very light on the cilantro, and it's not soapy tasting. But anyway, sorry. So it's a ground lamb patty. that is on a lightly toasted sesame seed bun. It has a little bit of mild white cheese on it, some fresh lettuce and tomato, and it is just delightful. We were able to sample it, and one of the people with us, one of our coworkers, called it the Joy Burger because it was just a delightful offering. It was really, really good. So go for it, you know, a must try.
Well, I love cilantro, but for those that don't, they don't want a soap burger, I guess.
No. And it's very mild. So I would say that it's such a lovely, warm, tasty burger.
I'm not making fun of the cilantro haters out there, but I am.
My mom is an anti-cilantro person just because of the soapiness in her, in her palate. So I can empathize with the non-cilantro people, even though I do appreciate the cilantro.
Well, moving along here, how can we like to have fun on this segment.
Yes, it's fun.
How can participating eaters enter their scores? We talked about the app a little bit, but is there a QR code, that sort of thing?
There is, yes. So at every restaurant, they have either table tents or check stuffers, coasters. All of the print material has a QR code on it that you can scan the QR code. It will take you to our website where you can vote. And it's on a scale of 1 to 10 and 5 different categories. So you'll be able to really easily get there and vote. Otherwise, you can go to downtown Bismarck if you forget to scan the code while you're there, and you'll be able to find it on our website right away.
And who won last year?
It was Laughing Sun.
Yes.
They won. They won the championship belt. So that is their award, is a WWE style championship belt with the Burger Slam logo on it. It's tons of fun. It was Laughing Sun last year, and JL Beers won the very first year.
I was just going to ask you about that wrestling belt because I'm a big fan of like 80s and early 90s wrestling.
Yes.
And I just love it. I think it's really fun.
It has been really fun to kind of play off of professional wrestling in some of the promotions and stuff that we've been doing. So, same with you. Growing up in the 80s and 90s, it was all about Friday night, Saturday night wrestling in our house as well. So, so much fun to do.
Well, Don, how can folks learn more about the Burger Slam?
Yeah, go ahead, go to Downtown Bismarck, and right on the very front page, you'll just be able to click right on the Burger Slam information, and it will lead you to our app. On the app, you can read all about the participating restaurants and what they have to offer, what burgers they have, and you can see a photo of the burger as well, just to kind of, you know, get you thinking and tease you somewhat, tease your taste buds, if you will, and get your plans in action, hopefully, your burger plans. But well, we have, so it's pretty easy to do. You can also, if you see a poster around town or a coaster, etc., you can just go ahead and scan that QR code and it will lead you to all the information.
Well, is there anything that I forgot to ask? Probably not about soap burgers, but...
No, but I would like to just point out some of the really interesting burgers or different types of burgers that people are serving this year.
Yes.
So, we have... Everybody did a new take. Last year, we kind of had a lot of spicy burgers, hot spicy burgers. This year, we have the burger different proteins. So, Jousting Lemur has a bison burger. Laughing Sun is doing an elk burger. Broadway Grill is doing a brat patty. So it's a bratwurst that is made into a patty form. And then let's see, we have a brisket burger at Peacock Alley. Blarney Stone is doing a smothered burger, basically, but the sauce is on the bottom, so it comes in on a plate. There's a truffle bordelaise sauce that's on the bottom, and then the burger is on top. So it's incredible. If you have had experience with a hot hamburger in the past, this is like if you go to...
I have.
And I mean, I love hot hamburgers.
Yes.
But this is elevated to the nth degree with some truffle oil and delightfulness. We also have a Brie burger called Don't Stop Brie Leaving at JL Beers. And
the names can get quite creative.
It's been so much fun. Anima Cucina, which is on the corner of 5th and Main, they are doing a burrata burger. So for people unfamiliar with burrata, it's mozzarella that is stuffed with kind of a creamy cheese, a soft creamy cheese. So when it comes together, it's all melty and delicious. Jomo House has a Vietnamese inspired sandwich. And let's see, the Elbow Room is doing something called the Train Wreck. So at the Roundhouse portion of the Elbow Room, it's another spicy burger, but sounds delicious. And then we have the Downtown Classic at the Radisson. You can get it at their restaurant or in the bar, and it is a half-pound breakfast burger. So farm-fresh egg, bacon, some delicious cheese. I mean, it's just like a delicious, wonderful way to start your day.
The elbow room's offering sounds like it could be somebody that's drinking too much Train Wreck.
I mean, true. It also plays off of their sister restaurant, the Roundhouse.
Yes,
which is the other side. So, but yes, it could be, and it all kind of plays together with the railroad that runs through the middle of downtown Bismarck.
These are all great places. I'm not picking on them.
I know. We're just having fun. So they've all brought their A game this year, and I'm very excited to try out a few in the next coming days.
Well, Don, thanks for being with us on Prairie Plates this week. Talking about the Downtown Bismarck Burger Slam, which is going on right now. So get out and try some burgers. There's 11 places to choose from. If I lived in Bismarck, I'd be there. Don, if you could call the managers of the Blarney Stone here, I'd gladly try that burger because that sounds awesome.
I wish they had some of those pneumatic tubes from the Bismarck Blarney to the Fargo one that we could just like shoot a long distance truffle bordelaise burger over to you.
Or beam it like in Star Trek.
Yes.
That would work,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. That would work. So you can also check out our social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram as well. So we will be doing some Facebook Live events to kind of wet your palate as well.
Sounds great. That's Don Kopp with the Bismarck Downtowners here on Prairie Plates this week. I'm Rick Eon, your host. We'll talk to you next week here on Prairie Plates.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. This past Monday, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention made a move that had leading public health experts fearful that previously preventable childhood diseases could make comebacks. More now from our regional news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Hey, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. It's another episode of Prairie Beat.
Yep, our weekly discussion of newsworthy topics from Prairie Public. Danielle, the news moves fast. Doesn't take a break, doesn't take a holiday. We don't have time to waste. So what's on the beat this week?
Well, with the holidays behind us and winter in full swing, illness season is also running full tilt. So it's easy to always be looking at that. But this week, we are going to be talking about an adjacent topic related to that, changes in policy at the Centers for Disease Control and how that may be affecting public health overall.
Yeah, maybe you heard about this by now, especially if you're a parent. I know you're paying attention to this. That really is a timely topic for discussion today. The CDC this week, and really they've been signaling this for a while now under the direction of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has changed or updated the recommendations for the childhood vaccine schedule. Now, RFK Jr. is someone who has certainly questioned and doubted the efficacy and safety of vaccines in the past, but until now, not a lot has changed at the federal level. But this week, it appears a seismic shift has begun.
Yes and no. So we can certainly get into that. For this topic, I was able to speak with a pediatrician from Sanford Health in Fargo.
Stephanie Hansen, pediatrician.
Yeah, already a pediatrician who has firsthand experience in treating children. I'm all ears, Danielle. What did Dr. Hansen have to say about all this?
She had a lot of things to say. So first, I asked her for her initial reactions to this. She told me these changes do not mean vaccines are going away, not being offered, or not being covered. But she says there could be ripple effects. So first and foremost, the actual changes.
The biggest gist of the change is there are 7 vaccines that were initially on the recommended schedule that have flipped now going into a risk-based recommendation, or what they call shared decision making. So they're encouraging families to discuss with their child's pediatrician whether or not their child should get that vaccine. So the large part of the vaccine schedule actually stayed the same, which is good. I think dialoguing with your child's pediatrician about your individual child is always a good thing.
North Dakota's public education requirements for vaccines haven't changed. The American Academy of Pediatrics, or AAP, hasn't changed their recommendations. Access for now isn't changing either, but Hansen says public trust in vaccines has been shifting for quite a while.
What I'm concerned about is going forward into the future, if there's any possibility that this could limit access to vaccines, if this could sow confusion or doubt in the public about the vaccine schedule and its safety. I think that's where my concern lies.
Yeah, okay. That sounds great. Love that journey for us. I mean, you know, no, not really. So 7 vaccines, which illnesses are we talking about here, Danielle?
Some of the illnesses are fairly common, but can also be pretty serious. So we're talking like flu, COVID, RSV, and rotavirus. My older son actually contracted rotavirus when he was about 2. Mm. It was miserable.
I bet.
And then there are diseases that are more rare, but can have pretty serious consequences later on. Those include hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and meningococcal. Hansen says the goals of vaccines for these types of illnesses are not only preventing sickness, but also preventing things like long-term chronic disease, organ injury, and even death. And she says the shots and the initial schedule has been studied a lot. So the vaccines are supposed to be given when babies and children are at an age where their immune systems can handle them, develop the immune response needed to ward off those diseases, and also protect them at vulnerable stages in their lives as well. A moment ago, I mentioned my son getting rotavirus when he was about 2. If he had contracted that as an infant, he probably would have required hospitalization. He was severely sick for 2 weeks straight, couldn't keep anything down. Dehydration was a big concern, and he lost a bit of weight, too, which you really don't want to happen with little kids.
Well, gosh, yeah, that sounds pretty awful. Now, I'm a little shocked by this because you would figure a Scandinavian country, you would be pretty progressive in its medical efficacy. Mm-hmm. I read that the new recommendations mirror that of Denmark's vaccine schedule. Is that right?
Yes, it is. So I asked Dr. Hansen about that. Now, she says the schedule works great for a country like Denmark because they have a pretty small population. And with universal health care, which is easily accessible, they can get to the doctor when they're sick. They can get to the doctor easily for preventative care. And they also have well-funded parental leave policies in that country, too. She says for a country like the United States, where people are uninsured or underinsured, along with other differences, this schedule isn't as ideal.
We have large-scale disparities in people's ability to access medical care, to afford medical care, in a vast difference in parental leave policies where people have to return to work shortly after having a child, leaving their kids more vulnerable. So there really is a lot of demonstrable differences between the situation between what families have access to in Denmark versus the United States. And a vaccine strategy is not a one-size-fits-all thing across the world.
Okay, so all this is really interesting, and I will also say as a parent, it's a little concerning to me too, because I think it just makes things perplexing for other families out there. The CDC says one thing, The AAP says another, and I know we can always talk to our doctors about these things, which is what RFK Jr. says to do, just consult with your own doctor. But clearly, with information coming at people from all different directions, it can be overwhelming and just confusing about who to believe. Maybe that's the point. Our doctor, our government, or what our friends and neighbors say, what the internet says, Facebook or whatever. It all seems to be converging at a time when vaccine hesitancy is, from where I sit, accelerating.
And from where Dr. Hansen sits, it's accelerating too. She's been a pediatrician for 18 years, and I asked her about what she's been seeing in her patient pool. She told me there's always been pockets of hesitancy about vaccines, but around 10 years ago, those pockets started growing, and they only grew more during and after the pandemic. She's a little worried about what the future may bring. She's concerned about resurgence and diseases she's never thought she'd see in person, like measles. The HPV vaccine has proven to have success in reducing cancer rates, and even the mRNA vaccines, which we learned a lot about during COVID, have shown promise in the treatment of other diseases, and she thinks the doubt could lead to setbacks.
I don't fault people, and I never want someone to feel bad for wanting to do right by their kids, but I really do feel that some of the concerns are unfounded, and that when we look to the science and we look to the history of vaccines, you know, the story of the development of vaccines is one of great success. It's done a tremendous job in reducing child mortality over history. I think we need to continue to look to that and remind ourselves of why vaccines have been developed in the first place and the great good that they have done for humankind.
Yeah, that's one thing I really agree with, too, that I really can't fault people for wanting to do right by their kids. I mean, that's what we do in our house, and I'm sure that's what you do as parents as well. It's just a matter of making sure we're finding sources of trustworthy information to help us make those important decisions. I know you, Danielle, as a news person, might not like to make statements like these, but Danielle, when the government becomes one of the places that adds to that confusion, I guess that's what makes me most nervous. But I did like what Dr. Hansen said about, you know, encouraging more discussion with pediatricians. That's a good thing, unless they're on Facebook all the time, I guess. But hopefully they're able to help families make the most informed medicine and science-based decisions. All right, so that in our rearview mirror. I'll get off my soapbox. So what else are you and Dave and Todd working on in the newsroom this week?
I'm very excited to see what these dollars can do in terms of helping with the workforce challenges as it relates to healthcare here in the state of North Dakota.
A special legislative session will start in a couple of weeks here to receive $199 million in federal money for the Rural Health Transformation Program.
They are right behind us. It makes it sound like they're in pursuit of us.
It's been 5 years since the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Todd produced a piece that looked back on that.
This truck responded to the Capitol fire in 1930. That's pretty impressive.
And Dave did a fun story about a 100-year-old fire engine coming back to life.
Oh, cool. Certainly a mixed bag of stuff going on there. I like that fire engine story. You know, the kid in me kind of comes out when I hear that. But that's no different from any other week in the newsroom. Lots of variety, lots of important topics. Thanks for all that, Danielle.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more local news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
Yeah, thank you for being with us on Prairie Beat this week. Thanks to Tay Calloway, our studio engineer and producer. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you back on the beat next week.
You can sign up for our Prairie Beat podcast wherever you get your favorites and listen to new episodes every Wednesday.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP. You never know where life will take you. A new job, a big move, retirement. That's why AARP offers resources to help you get ready for whatever is next. Learn more about planning tools and local events at aarp.org/moneytools.
Still ahead on today's Main Street, the University of North Dakota has reached a milestone as Anthony Lake has become its first graduate of the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Controller Training Program. It's an accelerated pathway that allows top students to move directly from campus simulations into live control towers, and Anthony will be our guest. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and air traffic controllers make thousands of split-second decisions every day decisions that most of us never see, but that keep millions of passengers safe in the skies. And as the nation faces a growing shortage of controllers, the Federal Aviation Administration has launched a highly selective, accelerated training pathway designed to move the very best students quickly from the classroom into the control tower. And the University of North Dakota is one of just a handful of schools nationwide approved for that enhanced program. And this winter, UND celebrated its very first graduate. Anthony Lake completed the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Collegiate Training Initiative, meaning he can move directly from UND into on-the-job air traffic control training, bypassing months of the FAA Academy. And it's my pleasure to be joined by Anthony Lake here today on Main Street. Anthony, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Pleasure that you are with us. This is very interesting to me. We've all heard about the shortage of air traffic controllers nationwide. It was certainly an issue during the government shutdown. So we have a lot to get to with you and your interest in becoming an air traffic controller. But before we start, tell me about yourself. What first drew you to aviation, and how did you end up choosing the University of North Dakota, and where are you from?
Yeah, so I'm from Faribault, Minnesota, about an hour south of the cities in Minnesota. And starting off, I didn't really grow up with an interest in aviation. It was just kind of discovered as I went to the University of North Dakota. I started going there because my sister was already getting a bachelor's of science up there. And my stepbrother said, well, maybe I'll go up for commercial aviation. And I said, I took a gap year because of COVID and was working in a factory. And I figured I'd rather go to college than keep working there. And my sister mentioned it's kind of like a video game. And I'm very big into those. I grew up playing and whatnot. So I tried it out for a year and found that I really liked it. And going into my second year is where I really developed my passion for aviation, specifically air traffic control.
So why air traffic control? There are obviously many things relative to aviation that you can participate in at UND. What really grabbed you about controlling America's skies?
It's definitely the rule book. I've always enjoyed trying to find the fine line of following the rules and getting as close to that barrier as possible. I mean, even with video games, you're always looking for ways to be as efficient as possible, be as close to that the line as you can. And having just this big 700-page document of here specifically what you do, how you do it, just kind of drove me to, there's no ambiguity. You're told how to do it and the proper way to do it.
So what's the hardest part of the program? We sense, and I say we collectively, that it's a high stress job. What is the hardest part of it for you?
The hardest part, honestly, was starting out. It's that big document I mentioned is called, it's the 7110.65. And I'll probably talk to it as the 0.65 is what we say. And starting off, they just kind of throw a bunch of rules at you. Here's what you need to know and try your best to keep up with it. But in the future classes, it's not nearly as many rules they're introducing, but just the amount of traffic coming at you. So this last class, which was Tower 3 or 464, no new topics were really discussed or thrown at us. It was just, here's getting back into the swing of things traffic for a week or two. Now we're upping it up. And from what I've been told by professors or associates is we were going towards a high level 7 airport amount of traffic.
So have you felt the stress? Have you felt that in your training that, hey, this is going to be tough relative to stress for a career?
Yeah. In any specific position, there's just the stress. You kind of get hit with a little bit of adrenaline. Things are coming at you and you can't pause at any point in time. So within a simulation, we run for 45 minutes. Times get stressful. It gets busy. But I'm telling myself, as soon as I figure out this problem, it slows down. We're good. And going home after class, after a simulation session, the stress doesn't follow me because maybe a fatigue might follow me. You know, mentally, a lot of power has to be used, but there's no real stress being brought home.
How do they teach you to manage the pressure that you inherently are immersed in when you're being an air traffic controller? How do you stay calm when things get busy, even though you're trying just to get through the next problem that comes your way?
This is something I kind of grew up with playing video games, is constantly things are being thrown at me. So I've had a lot longer to adapt to that mindset. So something I'd be complimented on after our sims is good job staying calm while it's busy, keeping the same speech rate that I've had. But other than that, working strips, we have certain procedures on how to do things in a certain order, and having those memorized and not having to think about them allows you to think more on the traffic itself and just make it easier overall. And then every once in a while we'd get busy and the professor would say, all right, take a breath, get the picture, and then you go back to it. So it's just even a quarter of a second to reset your mind for a minute can help you refocus on the bigger picture.
So was there a moment in your training when you realized, hey, this is the real deal, this is real for me?
Honestly, if there was, it wouldn't have been until my enhanced evals. The last, in December 19th is when I took them. Or correction, the 12th is when I took them. That maybe is when it was the real deal. I definitely see in the future when I go to my first tower and I'm in the cab and see actual airplanes. It's going to hit for sure there. As for like the simulations in class at the University of North Dakota, it's we don't communicate with real airplanes, so it's all simulations. So it's hard to get into the this is real mindset until your evaluations come around.
For those of us who've never seen the inside of a control tower or a radar room, what does a shift look like, or what will it look like when you go to that first tower?
Yeah, so I've gone on some tours. I have a mentor that's in the Farmington Center, and from the tours I've been on, what we've been told, it's about an hour and a half working and then 30, 45 minutes off, just because of the focus that you have to have during that shift. So if it's an 8-hour work day, maybe work 5-6 hours and 2 hours off of just resting for a minute and getting back into a mindset to where you can work. So overall, I mean, it's not nearly as bad in a terminal facility as a center like Farmington, but it's definitely still some time that you get off.
Are there jobs waiting for you pretty much anywhere in the country, Anthony?
So we did, Craig Carlson mentioned that other enhanced graduates, when they got a facility list, it was in just about any location in the country, being states and whatnot. So as for towers, every tower could definitely use more staffing. It's just where the FAA wants to prioritize. So until I get a list, I won't know exactly where in the country, but I'm hoping somewhere in the central southern Minnesota area.
One of the things that I know about this vocation from some friends of mine that I had in Wyoming is the required retirement age is much lower than almost any other vocation. What is it? And have you thought about that?
I definitely have thought about it, and that's part of why I wanted to get into this so much. The required age, from my understanding, is 56 and a half currently. And that's, they're kind of going to kick you out. You're getting too old to keep up. As for the earliest you can retire, at my current age and whatnot, it would be after 25 years of working. So I could retire at the age of 47. And looking at that, I still have to decide if I'd want to keep working, probably go somewhere to an easier facility if I can, just to have a lighter workload. But I've definitely looked into it and saw that the retirement age was something I desired.
Enjoying my conversation with Anthony Lake. He's just completed the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Collegiate Training Initiative at the University of North Dakota, the first student to do so. How much of the job, Anthony, is teamwork, and how much of it is just individual responsibility? You focused on one plane, your partner focused maybe on a different plane or runway. How does that all mesh together?
Yeah, so the job itself is, from what I've been taught and trained on, there is no individual responsibility. We are all a team. We are all there to help each other out. Even the .65 references that ground control is supposed to help local control scan the runway and help prevent if they see something unsafe, bring it up, tell them, hey, that looks close. And if it is taken care of in their separation, then no big deal. But if somebody isn't assisting you in looking and helping you separate and something goes wrong, yeah, we're all a team up there. It's a team responsibility, 100%.
In your training, what I've noticed is everyone is unbelievably calm in what the public is allowed, I guess, to hear or to see when accidents happen or some replays of communications between the tower and pilot or perhaps the tower and someone else. Have you come across in your training where that's not always the case? And then, hey, if this happens, this is what the procedure is.
Yeah. So starting off, I mean, kids get nervous. We start talking fast and we learn quickly that as we're talking fast, the other person can't understand us. We're getting lost in translation somewhere. So they really nail us to slow down, take time to pronunciate what you're saying, because if you talk fast and then have to re-say it, you just wasted the time you saved saying it quickly.
And English is the language of air traffic control across the world. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the official language of aviation.
So do you have any desire to work abroad at all, or do you want to stick around?
From what I've heard, the U.S. or the United States has different areas in some like southern islands and whatnot. There's also Hawaii, but that's still United States. As for abroad, they have their own air traffic control system. Like Australia is a different hiring pool. I'm sure the experience of working as an air traffic controller would give you a leg up over there, but it's different rules, different mindsets, different documents. So what I've been trained on, I think staying in the United States is what I would want to do for my career.
While training, you're making dozens and hundreds of decisions in a real short period of time. How do you learn to trust yourself that you're doing what's correct and not second guessing yourself as planes continue to come your way or leave your airspace?
Yeah, taking the brain process out of thinking how to do something and just doing it is the biggest thing. I mean, repetition of how to say something and how to say it correctly, as well as just how to document that you're doing it. I mentioned before, we use strips for each aircraft, and there's specific ways to write things, specific ways to say things. So using that repetition to the most of your ability definitely helps you, because then you're just saying what is ingrained in you. And then just practice. I mean, I could have become an air traffic controller without going to the University of North Dakota. I could have turned 18 and gone to the academy, but the extra 3.5-4 years that I've gained to practice is invaluable.
What happens in training when you make a mistake? Give us a scenario where you're working, you're paying attention, you're doing everything right, and all of a sudden you realize that you've made an error. In your training, what does that look like?
Yeah, so in our training, the professors, they do everything they can to not pause it, to let whatever is going to happen happen so you can see the consequences of your actions. So I had a situation where I'd turn an aircraft to base in front of a way faster aircraft, and now he's almost going to get run over. So the simulation is designed to work efficiently, get people landed, and then you don't have an issue. But now I have to send one of them around to let one land, and my pattern is just way more full than it has to be. So at that point, I just have to survive, and this next loop around, everybody will be on the ground having a full stop, and it gets way easier. But just taking that mistake and learning from it is really what you have to do when that happens.
You said you may want to stay in the region to work, Anthony. What does your pathway look like? What do you do now? Do you have to more testing, more certification, more training? What do you need to do to become a working air traffic controller now?
Yeah, so right now I'm not even employed by the FAA. People at the academy are air traffic controller trainees. So when they graduate, they'll be sent to a facility, and then we'll be in the same position of, it's a fight to CPC, to certify at your facility. And as soon as you fully certify in CPC, you are then able to work 100% on your own, no trainer over your shoulders. So it's getting to my first facility and working towards my certifications on each position in order to be an independent air traffic controller.
Have you thought about what it means to you personally about stepping into a role that's just so incredibly essential to public safety? We all hear that flying is one of the safest things that one can do relative to transportation, and air traffic controllers pretty much make that work. Have you thought about that responsibility and how essential you're becoming now to public safety?
I haven't thought so much about how I affect the safety of it, but more what the role means to me of, I'll find other people who care deeply for their job to keep the sky safe, and finding a community like that is really what I wanted in a position, others who care for their role and take it seriously.
I've wondered about the technology with air traffic control systems in the country. Are they old? Are they improving? Are we in a massive upgrade scenario? What's your feel for the technology that we have in place relative to air traffic control systems?
As for the technology used, I can't speak too much on it, as I don't really know. I'm not trained on it. From the facilities I've been in, I mean, it's all a different language to me. From what I've seen online and in media, the equipment is getting an upgrade. Currently, the FAA just posted, and it's definitely outdated, some of it. It's hard to try to modernize something unless it's breaking, especially on the scale that the United States has. I mean, other countries are a lot smaller, less facilities, but we have hundreds of facilities that would need to be upgraded all at the same time to try and keep everything on the same track.
What are your thoughts about AI advancement in your world? And do you still see the human role as irreplaceable relative to air traffic controllers, Anthony?
I definitely see humans as irreplaceable. In terms of AI, like, we already have computer systems that are tracking potential situations for collisions and different situations like that on the ground and in the air. As for AI, the current definition of AI, I don't think that'll be applied unless it's applied everywhere at once. There is just such a big space to do it. And if half the airplanes have it and half the airplanes don't, it would make it hard to incorporate it into just the overall use of it.
Now that you've made it through the program and are looking towards that first position, what advice would you give a student who's thinking about air traffic control, but maybe aren't sure that they're up to it?
Yeah, the thing I'd say is it's a skill like any other. I mean, I didn't go in knowing information about aviation. It was all brand new to me, and I was still able to pass it just fine. So if you're willing to practice it, you can do it. And it's like a big video game. It's like if you're playing Tetris, you're thinking two moves ahead, trying to line things up. But I'm in the spotlight now. Even before me and even after, there's going to be better students in positions like this now that will just be able to do the job better. I just happen to be at the right place in the right time. I just want to acknowledge the associates and the TAs at the University of North Dakota, associates being past graduates who are still in the limbo of hiring and helping current students get through their training as well, and the TAs being current students in the same role. Without them, the entire program wouldn't run. We wouldn't have remote pilot operators. We wouldn't have pseudos, and it just makes the whole thing go a lot more smoothly. So just a thank you to those guys.
When you look up at the sky and see a plane flying, what goes through your mind?
I wonder where they're going. Around where I'm at, it's usually little small airplanes, just getting some training in. But as for the big ones, I'm always looking up and I wonder how many jets are on there. I wonder if I can identify it, because that's something we weren't really able to do at school. We could practice identification via pictures, but you just don't get the scale of what the aircraft truly is. I mean, the size difference is very difficult to get within just pictures.
Anthony, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, have you been told what you can expect salary-wise, both as you begin your career and as you progress through it?
I have not been explicitly told anything, only information I find on the web and whatnot and from different posts. From my understanding, I would start off at about $50,000 a year as a trainee without any certifications in a tower. And then as I certify, I would get a raise. And again, from my understanding, maybe $80,000, $90,000 at a low-level tower. And then as you can get up there, like the most difficult being a level 12 out of level 12 would be close to $200,000, $220,000 some dollars. But it just depends on your certifications and how difficult the airport itself is.
What do you see yourself relative to continuing to be a student? How often do you have to, like pilots need to recertify, as it's my understanding, and have physicals and things as they progress through their careers? Is that something that also applies to air traffic controllers?
Yes, air traffic controllers also need a medical and different certifications. As for certifications on position, it appears to be more relevancy. Like the manager position within a tower needs to have a certain number of hours on each position to be able to maintain current within that. So if you fall out, maybe you'd have to take some recertifications. But once you're certified, unless you do something weird or go on a long vacation, then you're going to stay certified.
As we wrap it up, give me something that you would say to a pilot to maybe make him change course or realign? What, tell us how a air traffic controller will speak.
Yeah, so in my position, there's ground and local. On a ground position, I might say, runway 28 right, taxi via Charlie Bravo Alpha, hold short of taxiway Alpha. And I'd have him wait there for a minute until I'm ready to bring him up to the runway. And for local, I would Academy Tower, enter left down, runway 28 left, number 2, traffic and Archer on base, to get him into the pattern and following an airplane that's soon to turn final for the runway.
That's Anthony Lake. He's UND's first graduate of the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Controller Program, but he won't be the last. UND expects more students to follow this accelerated path in the coming years, helping strengthen the nation's air traffic system at a time when experienced controllers are urgently needed. Anthony, it's been a pleasure, and I wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Yes, thank you for having me.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Decoded 8 Book for January 7th. On this date, in 1797, fur trader J.B. Chaboy of the Northwest Company noted the arrival of Netnoqua and her sons at the Pemina Post. Chaboy called her La Couturier, or Long Earrings, meaning Ottawa. Neither Chaboy nor his successor, Alexander Henry, noted that one of her sons was a white man, so completely had he adapted to native life. Abducted in Kentucky as a child, Tanner had forgotten the English language by adulthood. His Shawnee captors might have killed him, but they encountered Netnoqua in Michigan. She was considered the principal chief of the Ottawa and customarily received gun salutes from soldiers at Fort Mackinac. A shrewd trader and leader, Netnoqua saw Tanner's potential and bought him from the Shawnee. Her husband taught Tanner to hunt, trap, and sustain the household. Tanner received the name meaning the falcon. Netnoqua sought new opportunity in the Red River fur trade. During the long, dangerous journey, her husband and older son died. Tanner revered them, but his remaining brother disappointed her in character and hunting ability. Netnoqua's tent welcomed relatives who were skilled hunters and mentors, as well as women and children. Netnoqua and her male associates guided Tanner in spiritual matters, rites of passage, hunting methods, marriage, and the practical realities of survival and trade. Tanner became the leading hunter of his bandlet and a first-hand witness to important events in tribal and fur trade history. Netnoqua enjoyed practical jokes and once placed a live rabbit in a kettle of frozen fat, expecting it to jump out when Tanner returned hungry from winter exertions. Instead, the rabbit drowned as the fat melted. Another time, she told Tanner of a vision of a bear sleeping in its hole in a slough. Tanner followed her instructions and found the bear, saving his household from starvation. He later believed Netnoqua had tracked the bear herself and revealed its location to him. In 1820, Tanner met Edwin James, a physician and botanist, on the Red River Expedition led by Major Stephen Long. James later worked with Tanner to write his memoir, published in 1830. Tanner expressed great regard for Netnoqua throughout her life. The book was a popular success and remains an important historical and cultural record. Today's Dakota Date Book is written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to us as your favorite podcast. Tomorrow on the show, North Dakota farmers are facing prolonged financial stress as they head into 2026, and we'll visit with Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor, and he's done significant reporting about what's ahead for our state's agriculture industry. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.